Bienvenue à tous et à toutes. Et on est très heureux d'accueillir aujourd'hui le professeur Gabriel Cotliard, que je pense tout le monde dans cette salle connaît, ou presque. Donc je ne pense pas que Gabi ait besoin d'une très longue introduction. C'est un théoricien pionnier de la physique des fortes corrélations électroniques. Il est connu pour un très grand nombre de travaux dans ce domaine, mais également pour des travaux sur la localisation en présence d'interactions. Et il a très gentiment accepté de se charger de la lourde tâche de présenter 4 cours sur la route vers les supraconducteurs à haute température, ou à plus haute température. Donc je pense que c'est un très très grand défi. Et je lui souhaite de faire ces conférences de manière apaisée. On n'attend pas de lui qu'il nous donne le supraconducteur à température ambiante aujourd'hui, mais de dresser une sorte de panorama de ce qu'on comprend des mécanismes qui régissent la supraconductivité et éventuellement de pistes pour augmenter TC. It's all yours now.
Okay. So thanks very much, Antoine. Is the microphone on?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. All right. So I'd like to start by thanking Antoine for the invitation. It's a great pleasure always to be here. And it's a great pleasure to give me this opportunity to give these 4 lectures where what I will try to do is paint sort of a broad picture of the field of superconducting materials. So why did I pick this subject? Well, I'm a condensed matter physicist, and I think that superconductivity really epitomizes what is condensed matter physics all about. It's really a typical example of condensed matter physics activity, and it's really has all the elements of the most challenging condensed matter physics problem. Also, it's 100 years after the discovery of superconductivity, and since then many people have promised high temperature superconductors without really delivering, but advancing the field a lot. So I thought it's a good time to step back and take a look in sort of a very, very broad view to see what has been done in this field. Now, I say that superconductivity is a typical problem in condensed matter physics. Condensed matter physics always has the problem that is sort of sandwiched, at least in the US, that is sort of sandwiched between astrophysics, which deals with a very, very, very long distance, and the high energy physics, which deals with the very, very high energy and the very short distance. We seem to be stuck in the sort of an intermediate range of energies and scales. And a colleague of mine once said that it's condensed matter theory is really the theory of everything, but of everything of everyday life. So it's actually relevant. But I'd like to say, and that's why I like superconductivity, that superconductivity is a field, or is a problem where all the physicists from all disciplines really challenged with. I mean, it's a field that Einstein tried to solve the problem of superconductivity, and Landau, and basically almost every physicist tried its hands on this, Richard Feynman, and was not solved by them, but it was solved by Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer, which really epitomized the way that research in condensed matter physics is done, which is in very, very close proximity with experiment. Also, superconductivity has impacted the fields outside condensed matter physics. So even though it's an intermediate length scales, the lessons that we learned really explained lots of things in high energy physics. And the ideas of superconductivity are basic for understanding the Higgs mechanism in non-abelian gauge theories. It's just an extension of Anderson's ideas for a U1 gauge theory. And it also explains things that happen very, very far away in astrophysics, such as neutron stars or pulsars. And it's also important for nuclear physics, where nuclei, which are even, are also described by the BCS theory of superconductivity. So superconductivity is very, very general, and it's an example of an emergent phenomena. It's something where we really know very well what happens in a solid at very short distance, where we know roughly what is the structure of a material, but we need to predict what happens at much lower energies, at much lower temperatures. For example, we want to understand phase diagrams, we want to understand the critical temperatures of materials. And as I said before, the field moves sort of slowly, and it moves through an interplay of theory and experiment, and looking sort of from a very, very broad view at how superconductivity has advanced over 100 years gives a very, very beautiful demonstration of that. And of course, for workers in the field, we know that, but I think it's useful for students to see how science in this area actually made progress. And another reason why this is typical of condensed matter physics is because even though we're working in basic research, some of the applications, some of these things have applications, and we're always thinking about possible applications, and superconductivity is something which has proved itself because it's being applied, say, for MRI machines, it's applied for designing half-field magnets. It's really a very, very useful product. And in this day and age, we're sort of short of energy, and it's an area where material science actually can, society can use material science, and we need to make progress in materials more than ever. The other thing that the field illustrates is the deep connection between technical advances, how technical advances enable scientific discovery and understanding, and then it feeds back into further scientific discovery and technical advances. I'm a theorist, and there's always a tension in the community between more qualitative model Hamiltonian type of ideas and first principles calculations. And in this field of superconductivity, now the two are beginning to play a synergetic role. So it's sort of an interesting time to look at this. So those are just a partial list of my motivations. And by the way, if there is any questions or comments, please stop me at any time if anything is not clear. So the plan of the lectures is then to give a guided tour of the landscape of interesting superconducting materials. Many of them are strongly correlated. Some of them are not so strongly correlated. This is, of course, a subject which is really at the heart of the debate in the community. So I think it's something good to give lectures on and discuss. And I will sort of stress the open issues as well as the current understanding of the problem. So I will not only run you through materials, this will not be stamp collection, but I will also tell you what to look for. In some sense, you can think of it sort of an excursion in a huge space where we know some landmarks, we know some materials, and I will tell you some possible things that you may want to look at to try to get a grand view of what's common or what's sort of the shape of that landscape. Now, I should say from the very beginning that we have somewhat an incomplete understanding, and we also have limited experimental information, and we also have fairly primitive theoretical tools. So to make progress in this, we need everything, and the lecture will combine information from theory, phenomenologies, and experiments. And that sort of reminded me of a quote that I heard recently in in a conference, and for those who don't know Latin, it means that of this, many have said many things, all something, but no one enough. We don't really have a complete view of what's happening here, so we're going to start our excursion, bon voyage. Okay, so to start, or sort of to set the stage, I'd like to give, at least for the students, some fairly general definitions of what we mean by superconductivity. And I would say that even though at the beginning of the discovery of the cuprates, there were some arguments as to whether the pairing idea applied or did not apply to cuprates, I should sort of say that now there is consensus in the community that it does apply, and therefore I will sort of start with the definition of pairing and phase coherence as the basic definition of superconductivity. Now, if you want to make precise sense of what does it mean by pairing and phase coherence, these are sort of words, we need to go to the work of Young and define what we mean by this. So I would like to now get the light. So I guess I need to use this one. Yes. Yeah. To use the blackboard. So to know, I would like to start with the definition, which does not refer to mean field theory. It doesn't refer to any particular model. To know what Xi and Yang taught us is that if you want to know if a material is superconducting or not, what we need to look is at the correlations between particles. So we are going to go and destroy two particles where R1 is near R2 and create them very far away. So, but we're going to take the distance between these particles to be very, very, very far away. So we're going to take the distance between the pairs to be very far away. And this expectation value is a thermal expectation value. So if the system is normal, all the correlations of a normal system have to decay with distance. The system is superconducting, according to Xi and Yang, if this correlation function doesn't decay. And therefore, it goes to some finite value, which therefore defines for us what we call the pair wave function. So we can think of this object, which is rigorously defined, as, if you wish, the wave function of the Cooper pairs, or what's behind this cartoon that is in this transparency, in which we think that two electrons with opposite spins are correlated with each other. Now, we're going to look at many different materials in our lectures, and therefore, this wave function can have very different shapes. And the simplest thing that can happen is if this wave function, which for the time being I will take to depend only on the relative distance of the coordinates, think of this as just the wave function of the pair, is in a singlet state. So as far as the dependence on sigma 1 and sigma 2, this is going to be proportional to the Pauli matrix sigma y, which means that these electrons are actually forming a singlet pair. And as far as the relative coordinates, then we are going to first take this to depend only on the relative coordinates. And this can form an S wave state, which is the case of most of the elemental superconductors, or it can have some non-trivial structure in the spatial coordinates, in which case we talked about an isotropic pairing. So more precisely, let's stay first with singlet pairing. We can look at the Fourier transform. So we look at the Fourier transform of this quantity, which is now a function of wave vector k. And we can ask the question whether this function has this all the lattice symmetry. So there any lattice or has a symmetry group G, and if this function is invariant under all the operations of the group, then we say that we have S wave pairing. So we are going to require for S wave pairing that G acting on phi of k will give us back phi of k, in which case this is really the superconducting order parameter. Now, we're going to see as we visit many materials that, at least in correlated materials, this is actually rather exceptional. The rule is that this wave function will have more interesting transformation properties. A very famous example is in cuprates, where if we perform a rotation by 90 degrees, what's called C4, then it turns out that this wave function actually gets multiplied by minus 1, which means that the k structure of this wave function is of the form cosine kx minus cosine ky, or more precisely in group theory language, this transforms according to the B1G rather than the identity representation of the group. So there are many, many possibilities, and that's one of the things that we will need to look at when we look at the various materials which become superconducting. Namely, well, what is the symmetry of the pair wave functions? Now, I said that the spins in elemental superconductors or in the BCS theory form singlets, but that doesn't really need to be the case. And there are many examples going back to helium-3 in which the state which is chosen is in fact a state with spin 1. So two electrons can pair and have a spin as degrees of freedom. And in this case, we will talk, for example, in the case of helium-3, we have S equals to 1 and L equals to 1 form of pairing. And then the situation gets very, very rich. Then if you want to think of the wave function of the state of this system, then it can be expanded in terms of the quantum numbers of the spin and the angular momentum. And then the order parameters now becomes, instead of just being one number, becomes actually 18 quantities because these phases are complex. So there is a lot to see, and turns out that nature has been extremely kind and provides us examples by now of all different types of pair wave function. So there's really a lot to look at. And I will start, though, with the simplest case of S-wave pairing. I should say, however, that even when the wave function transforms in a, like the identity representation, it transforms in a trivial way under all the symmetry groups of the lattice, and therefore only the U1 symmetry is broken, still can have structure because this K dependence can be non-trivial. And we'll discuss that when we get to the nictides, where some of the, it seems by now that there is some evidence that this is an S-wave superconductor in the sense that the wave function of the pairs is invariant under the symmetry group of the lattice, but nevertheless has actually non-trivial structure in the Brillouin zone, which is a subject of active debate. So I just wanted to start by getting sort of the definitions of what we need to look at in a very, very precise way. And symmetry, what symmetry is broken? It's broken by the onset of superconductivity. Is a question that what we would like to answer for different materials. And the answer can be just simply U1, which for sure is broken, because any time that you have a wave function where, which is occupied by really all the electrons, by all the pairs occupy the same wave function, it picks a phase. It locks the phase of the whole sample, so the U1 symmetry is broken, but in addition, there can be more things. There could be lattice symmetries, there could be space symmetries, and we will like to clarify that in the various examples that we look at. So, yes? Right. Okay. So, that was sort of my interest in this. I think that the experiments should be repeated in other materials. There are efforts in ruthenates, for example, to try to pin the symmetry of the pairs using that technique. There have been serious efforts on UPT3 recently in the group of Bill Halperin in Northwestern to try to do that. So I agree with you entirely, and that's what I said at the beginning. We don't know enough. But that's something that, in principle, could be done in other superconductors. And it's important if we want to ever understand sort of this landscape. It's such a basic question, and it teaches us something about what is doing the pairing, that more experimental and perhaps also theoretical effort is required to pin the symmetry. But I agree with you. Yeah, on the other hand, the number of groups and their representations is finite. So, and there's serious experimental efforts. So I think that it's something that will continue attracting a lot of attention. In the cuprates, it was determining the fact that under rotations one picks a minus sign took a lot of time, and it was sort of quite important. So far, all I'm trying to do is just sort of say what we look at and what to look for and what to think about. And even though it's very hard to do experimentally, as you know, for theorists, it's a pleasure to diagonalize matrices and look at eigenvalues, and that's one of the things that one looks at a lot. Okay, so that's one thing which I think is something to take notice. The other thing which is sort of important, since we are going to talk about correlated materials and weakly correlated materials, is about what are the characteristic length scales of these things. So we have our wave function psi, and we defined the order parameter. Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, sure. Sure. Please, and you can ask. So if anything is not clear, please ask. At this point, I'm just trying to set the stage of what we're going to look at. So the second thing that I think is sort of important is to define the length scales of the problem. And then we can also do that if we have this pair wave function. Let's sort of stay with the S wave state for the time being. So we're simply going to neglect completely. And let's take the simple case where we can actually approximate just this by some value at KF. We can then restore, we can restore the dependence on the center of mass momenta. I mean, this function is a function of two coordinates, R1 minus R2 and R1 plus R2 over R, over 2, which is just the center of mass momenta. And that basically gives us what Landau calls the Landau-Ginzburg order parameter. In the S-wave case, it's very simple to write because there's just one phase, and Landau-Ginzburg in the 50s showed that this has a very simple form. And this coefficient is related to the stiffness of the order parameter and can be probed electromagnetically, because once we have a form of the free energy, then we can simply generalize that to the presence of electromagnetic fields by having I2E over HC A of capital R, and add, and in this case, we can, this free energy describes the degree of expulsion of the magnetic field in a superconductor, and this coefficient K times phi square is what's called the superfluid stiffness, or is directly related to the penetration depth 1 over lambda square. It governs how strongly fluctuating the phases are. So that's one length that is a famous length in superconductors. And in correlated materials, it's a very interesting question, and it's a subject of many phenomenological theories, how important these phase fluctuations are. So this is something that in an excursion in the space of correlated materials, we have to look for. The other quantity, which I think is important to know, is what's called the P part coherence length, which is again some characteristic size of the pairs. Once we have our wave function, we can actually take the average radius of the pair. And in standard superconductors, this was extremely long, and the cartoon looked a little bit like in this transparency, that the pairs are extremely far away from each other. The members of the pairs are very, very far away from each other. As we crank up the correlations, then this length scale gets shorter. And it's important to think about what is it in any specific material. So those are sort of very general things that we can get from the two-particle density matrix if we can sort of understand, calculate it. But also, it gives us sort of some rigorous way of thinking about the superconductivity in various materials. And any questions so far? No? Okay. So to summarize so far, we know something. We know that superconductivity results from BCS pairing, but we have very basic questions, and I mentioned one already, which is the symmetry and the characteristic length scales in correlated materials. But there are others which we need to look at as we examine the various materials. And one question that has attracted a lot of attention is how we think about the superconductivity, because just having some definition in terms of pairs is not tells you precisely what gets paired. And historically, in the simple elements, what happens is that we understood very well what gets paired, because Landau taught us that if we go to a sufficiently low energy regime, which for all the elements is basically all the energies that we can actually access, the electrons behave essentially as quasiparticles, which are essentially non-interacting entities. They behave as non-interacting fermions, but in the presence of molecular fields and with effective parameters. And then as we continue lowering the temperature, superconductivity intervenes. And the way that the superconductivity takes place is via the pairing of quasiparticles. So what happens in all the elements is that superconductivity is the result of pairing well-defined eigenstates of the many-body problem, which we understand fairly well. And as a result, for elements, we have a very precise, and we can make these things fairly precise using renormalization group ideas for fermions. We can make very precise that we understand where the superconductivity comes from in the case of elements. So we view this the process of reaching the superconducting state as sort of a two-stage process. First, the electron gets dressed by the medium and forms the quasiparticle, and then at the second stage, the quasiparticle pairs and give rise to the superconducting state. It turns out that that's also what happens in helium-3, where the superconductivity occurs at very low temperatures, or superfluidity occurs at low temperatures, but it turns out that in many of the strongly correlated materials, but not in all of them, it seems that this Fermi-liquid stage is not really observed when we look at the experiments. And then we have a more difficult question, because to the extent that we don't have a good model to describe the eigenstates of the system, it's hard to answer the question of what exactly are we pairing when we go superconducting, even though we know we're pairing something. And that's the question of what is the mechanism for superconductivity that I will try to define more rigorously a little bit later in this set of lectures. Now, I will sort of start by describing Migdal-Eliasberg theory in this course. There are many reasons for doing that, but Antoine told me that people are familiar completely with BCS theory, but not necessarily, the students not necessarily are familiar with Migdal-Eliasberg theory, so I'll try to derive it. And there is many reasons why I think it's good to go through a derivation of this, and more important, reconsider the validity of this approach. The first reason is that this was really the first attempt to describe pairing, even when the electron-phonon coupling was somewhat strong, So around the characteristic frequency of the phonon, the lifetime of the electron was very large. Still, Migdal and Eliasberg, exploiting the fact that the phonons were much slower than the electrons, managed to build a somewhat rigorous framework to describe pairing in that case. It's also, I'm very interested these days in what controls critical temperatures, and the Migdal-Eliasberg framework in the hands of Bill McMillan was one of the earliest attempts to ask the question, what really controls critical temperature? What parameters in the material should I look at if I want to try to increase TC? And the third reason, for discussing this is that this approach is very much in vogue. It's probably the more popular theory these days of cuprates in connection with and heavy fermions in connection with spin fluctuation theories, in the sense that there are attempts to take the framework of Migdal and Eliasberg and try to replace the phonon for which the theory was constructed, but some other bosonic excitation. So without really going through the derivation and the framework, we cannot really assess to which extent it's a reasonable thing to do or not. So those are sort of the reasons for reviewing that. The other motivation for teaching myself what I needed to teach this course is that I think it's sort of a very exciting time in condensed matter physics, because, as I said, the problem of defining the mechanism is that without some understanding of the normal state, it's hard to say what is happening to it when we go superconducting. But now we have dynamic mean field theory and its extensions, and that seems to describe reasonably well the incoherent state of many oxides. So we have some framework in which we can attempt to think about the normal state, and once you have such a framework, then we can define more precisely what is the mechanism for superconductivity, and I'll try to give some examples of how, at least with cluster dynamic mean field theory, we can start formulating this question and perhaps starting to answer it. So those are sort of my motivations and the motivations for the lectures. So given this motivation, what can we do? Well, I think that those are sort of very general questions, and the way to address that is by first looking through many, many materials and many compounds and look at them with the big picture question that I framed in mind. Those are questions that the community in condensed matter physics is asking themselves now, and we are beginning to have some tools to answer partially some of the questions. So it makes sense to take a step back and look at materials over the years with those questions in mind. And when we look at that, as I said, we don't have a complete theory of correlated materials. So what we will do is we're going to try to search for trends within families of materials and within each family and between families. And there are many ideas of how to try to optimize TC or what controls TC and or what's going on in the superconductivity of interesting materials. And I right now just name a few. I mean, there are the ideas that in correlated materials, superconductivity always occurs near some competing order, or more generally, that high temperature superconductivity can only occur in near some other competing phase. There are ideas that Fermi surface nesting can be optimized to try to reach higher TCs. There are the ideas that quantum critical fluctuations are needed to have high temperature superconductivity. I mean, those are various competing ideas in the community. So I thought, well, we can at least look at some at lots of materials and see what experiments are telling us. And there exist interesting phenomenologies which are trying to do that. They're trying to correlate some properties in the normal state with superconducting properties, such as the TC, or to correlate TC with other superconducting properties. And I'll just mention a few, and we'll go through that as I introduce more the materials. This Ohm's law to try to characterize how resistive a material is and how that relates to the critical temperature. There are people who think that by looking at an MR relaxation rate, we can get an idea whether something will be a superconductor, a high-temperature superconductor or not. So we look a little bit at those correlations. There are thoughts that the renormalization of the kinetic energy says something about when a material is likely to be superconducting. There's the famous Uemura plot, which is correlating stiffness and critical temperature. There are still the BCS ideas of trying to correlate the critical temperature with a specific heat. So there are things that we can look at. There's a lot of material to prepare these lectures. And the hope is that by examining these things, we may come up with some new set of rules, at least, of what's reasonable for trying to find better superconductors. And in this context, I should say that in the 50s and the 60s, before and after BCS theory, and that probably continues till today, it's really empiricism and solid-state chemistry which has been driving this field of strongly correlated materials. Okay, so I also thought that by just looking at many examples, we can look a little bit at the process of discovery of materials and look at the interplay of theory, techniques, and discovery of materials, even if, as I said, the field of high-temperature superconductors is a field which is still driven by solid-state chemistry and serendipity, which to me says that there is really a theoretical opportunity for us to try to do something in that area. And then towards the end of the course, I'll show some of the work I've been doing at Rutgers with my group, trying to understand if with realistic electronic structure calculations, we can say something about in which direction we should nudge the materials to try to improve their critical temperature. So that will come towards the end of the course. First, I have to give the basics, and I thought that to sort of set the stage of sort of the landscape of materials, I would walk you a little bit slowly through this fairly busy slide that people flash very quickly to say that TC increases as a function of time. What I would like to do is I would like to use this to at least introduce you and familiarize you with the various things which are out there. This is sort of a very partial list, but it already tells you something about what is sort of the playground for solid-state physicists which are sort of are inclined to look at materials. And by the way, if there are any questions or comments, please, yes. Why decrease? Oh no! I mean, basically, the okay. So let's look at it basically how it really happens. So let's start slowly. Because it's sort of very busy. So let's start very slowly. Let's start with the elements. So the way that the process works is first somebody has luck and discovers something very important. And then after you luck out, then within the class, the thing goes up for a while. So here, basically, we start with Ohms, there's Mercury, and then we end up with Niobium, and more or less, people move to a different place. The second sort of stage comes when people decided to look at binaries. And what happened there is that through various experimentations, they discover something which are called A15 compounds. And again, the discoveries were actually motivated. By the way, all the discoveries are really motivated, are allowed by advances in technique. The reason why Ohms was able to find superconductivity in Mercury is because he had spent many years of his life trying to liquefy helium before to go low temperatures. The reason why people were able to make day 15s is because they really advanced the technique of how to do arc melting in furnaces, etc. I mean, so this looks sort of like random, but it's not random. It's the result of concerted effort by many humans trying to make progress in the field of materials. So here we sort of have binaries. We have sort of the A15s. And again, the discovery of one material then leads very quickly to another rapid progress in that area. And that's sort of the field of in the 50s and the 50s and the 60s. And I should say that in 1957 and 1960, that's where BCS and the Migdal-Eliasberg theory were developed. And my experimentalist friends like to remind me that there's not even a kink in the TC versus time in the year of the discovery. But I think that that's actually quite expected, because it takes quite a lot of time for understanding and developing the techniques before one can actually revolutionize a field theoretically. So this really provided a lot of insight, but was not really to the point that one can understand specific systems and guide, even answer the question of whether there is a limit to how high the critical temperature can actually be. Now, still, the theory of that allowed very rapid interpretation of what the superfluid phases of helium were when they were discovered in 1973. So the theory for superfluid helium in some primitive stage already existed before it was actually discovered. So theory actually helps, it, at least in terms of suggesting things for experimentalists to look at. Now, in the 1980s and the late 70s, really there is a revolution in this field because of the birth of the so-called correlated superconductors. And that took place, in fact, in two places. It took place in Germany in the group of Steglitz, who discovered the possibility of heavy fermion superconductivity. And once you have a line of research again, you follow it with various materials. And that's here the green line going from cerium copper silicon 2, which was the material that was discovered, and staying fairly low. But eventually, it can actually go up. And the latest discovery in this heavy fermion class, which are these green dots, are this plutonium cobalt gallium 5, which is a heavy fermion superconductor, which now has reached 20 degree Kelvin. So Antoine, one can say perhaps that the rule is that things increase until they reach 20 degree Kelvin, and then things stop. But now, sort of more seriously, there is a lot of things which are actually not understood in this area of heavy fermion superconductivity, and not even what controls the critical temperature within a family of compounds is something that we actually know. Now,
question which is so guidance.
Well, okay.
Actually, I don't know because I was not born.
No, I also was not born. I was also. No, I was born the year. I was born the year that the BCS theory was discovered. But I know a lot about this through talks with people like Zachary Fisk, who have been educating me. I mean, the person who's largely responsible, two people are largely responsible for these discoveries, and those are John Holm and Bernd Matthias. And they had formed their own intuitive ideas of preferred number of particles, preferred density of states. And history sort of says that they always tried to argue that BCS theory, in the sense that just looking for the density of states in the band structure calculation, was not such a good guide, probably because at the time they didn't have computer programs good enough to compute F square of omega and to try to predict really what the electron-phonon coupling would look like. And therefore, they just resorted to primitive rules, and they were not really using the insights of BCS. Even though a posteriori, one should say that one should be able to derive those empirical rules from the basis of the Migdal and the Ashbrack theory, now that we can calculate the electron-phonon coupling from first principles. Now, what people were doing in those days, in the 50s and the 60s, were looking at experiments. And from experiments, they were extracting alpha square F, which is the electron-phonon coupling. They didn't have the possibility of predicting it, and therefore, they were not able to guide. But that can change now, for example. But the history, and people feel very strongly about that, is that all this was done without any help, or perhaps with hindrance from just looking at plain band structure density of states, which is what could be done at the time. And the reason for that is probably because the density of states does not really look exactly as the weighted strength of the electron-phonon coupling, which is what was needed to discover superconductivity. And I should also say that these A15s are still not completely understood theoretically, and there's still a lot of debate whether they can be understood in the Migdal-Eliasberg framework. So I would say that the only thing which we really understand is this very, very, very small corner here, where we can actually do everything, get the numbers, compare with the experiment, and say that the problem is solved. Okay, so I went through the heavy fermion materials. Almost at the same time, there was a major discovery in Orsay, which is the discovery of superconductivity in organic materials under pressure. That also started a line of research, just like heavy fermion started a line of research. This started the field of organic superconductivity, discovered by Jerome and Bachgard in Orsay. And that also continued to increase. And I think that now we have organic compounds around 12, 13 Kelvin that superconduct without the need of pressure. So those materials are probably correlated outside the scope of BCS theory. There are also some, and that takes me to the carbon era. There are now many compounds based on carbon that are known to superconduct. And the buckyballs is one of them, which also are not well understood. And there's also carbon nanotubes, which can superconduct under some conditions around 15 degree Kelvin. So even carbon now is turning into a high temperature superconductor. And there are also very interesting intercalated compounds of carbon, which also have critical temperatures above 10 Kelvin. Another odd member of this is the barium lead bismuth oxide. That was one of the first oxides not containing copper, which superconducts around 30 degree Kelvin. This seems to be an S-wave superconductor, and I'll have some things to say in the last part of my course. And there's, of course, the famous example of magnesium diboride, which is probably the highest TC for an electron phonon superconductor. And last but not least in this landscape, we have all the iron nictides. And what this graph is meant to illustrate is, at least while the pace of discovery of the initial discovery, it's painfully slow, what has sped up a lot is, once you have the initial discovery, the process of optimization, in the sense that the critical temperature of these materials was optimized within months rather than within years, which is the time scale of other systems, like, for example, the copper oxides, which are still the highest temperature superconductors known so far. It's 160 under pressure. And that's really good enough to, one can say that it's not room temperature superconductivity on the Earth, but it's certainly room temperature superconductivity on the surface of the Moon, where it's fairly close. So in some sense, we're sort of not very far. We sort of are halfway there. So that's sort of a little bit of an overview of what are the things that we can take a look at. And yes, well, depends. It was not within the Matthias empirical rules. I will hopefully today end with magnesium diboride, and that didn't fit what Matthias knew, in the sense that it was not cubic. He only looked at cubic phases. It didn't have transition metals. He felt that transition metals was the best way to go, so it contradicted its empirical rules. The history is that people, in fact, in 1957, had measured the specific heat of magnesium diboride in somewhere in the US. But unfortunately, they measured it in a very, very, very coarse grid, and they completely missed the transition. If they had discovered it then, it would have really changed the course of history, because then all the funding would not have continued to go to transition metals, and people would have started what they're starting to do now, which is exploring the carbon route of trying to get very, very strong electron phonon coupling. So it's sort of a bit of accident. As I'll show, magnesium diboride is a problem that, after it was discovered, within 4 months, it was completely solved theoretically, because these people build the tools, and we have now computational methods for estimating the electron-phonon coupling. And in those days, people were not doing this type of calculation. The fact that we can now are beginning to routinely estimate the electron-phonon coupling of a material is somewhat of a novelty. It's 21st century physics. So those are the reasons. There may be others, but I'm not surprised. I mean, people who knew Matthias, all his students, tell me he was a very opinionated guy. He was not very, so he did not look where his rules did not lead him to look, in some sense. But again, how much time did the poor theories have? Because again, working methods, I mean, I learned all I know about electron-phonon coupling realistic calculations from Sergei Savrasov when he was our postdoc at Rutgers, and that work was more or less finished in the 2000s. So it was fairly hard to do. The linear response theory of density functional theory was only implemented also 10 years ago. So it's not that the guys at Bell Labs could have just plugged in something and tried to estimate lambda. What they tried very hard is to find empirical rules of what governs lambda. And there, even till now, there's no progress. I mean, I asked Sergei, he told me that trying to find large electron-phonon coupling is like going to a casino, because you can take a material, you can change things a little bit, and the results can change a lot. So it's really a very, very difficult task. So Anyway, that's where we are. And then now I'll just start saying a little bit something about the elements and start the materials, just visit various materials just from the on a case by case. And Mercury was the first one. The interesting thing is that he really wrote in his notebook Mercury practically zero, because he was trying to answer a theoretical question, actually. He was trying to figure out if when you go, if you have a metal, does the resistivity go to zero or go to infinity? He didn't dream that there would be a jump in the resistivity, because those are the various possibilities that existed at the time. So the discovery of superconductivity, even though it's purely experimental and it's driven by technical advances, also involves some desire to answer some theoretical question. And even in that sense, I think theory plays an important role. And that's why I think it's important to try to answer the questions of, or try to formulate theories of mechanisms. Because even if the theories turn out not to be completely correct, they can motivate experiments, which then lead to unexpected directions. And that's the process of interplay of theory and experiment in condensed matter theory, which I think all students have to become very familiar with, because I think it's at the heart of our discipline. OK, so now this summarizes now basically all the elements. And basically, lead is the best, is the typical example of strong coupling superconductivity. Palladium is a very, very interesting example. It only superconducts when it's irradiated. If it's not irradiated, palladium is not a superconductor. And in fact, it was the desire to understand why palladium doesn't superconduct, even though it has strong electron-phonon coupling, which led Burke and Schrieffer to formulate the theory of spin fluctuations, which is now the basic credo for trying to understand heavy fermions and high TC. So palladium is really an interesting mystery for the people which are working in the theory of electron-phonon coupling, because it does not really fit sort of the paradigm. And one can already observe something by staring at all the elements, that there seem to be only a few structures. And I think this is a very, very important lesson, because I think it's also true when we go to the families of the materials. There are many, many, many possible structures. I mean, in this space of materials, we've only touched the surface, and only few structures are conductive to high temperature superconductivity or to reasonable superconductivity. And in this case are the FCCs and the BCC structures. And that's basically one of the bases of the Matthias rules for trying to find high temperature superconductivity. Now, there's a new axis now in our attempt to find materials. And this should be viewed as the continuation of Ohm's program. I mean, Kamerlingh's Ohm's was trying to study every possible element. And his dream was to really look at the resistivity of all elements. And he was systematically going one by one. Now, with the advances in experimental technique to do high pressure, the field has broadened a lot. So this, again, is information which is available in the web. And what he shows us is that while the blue compounds were the ones which superconduct at ambient pressure, the green ones are the ones that superconduct when we apply high pressure. And applying pressure essentially doubles the number of materials that we have that become superconducting. And even iron, which was a very, very, very strong itinerant ferromagnet, can be convinced to become superconducting if you put on iron enough pressure, actually 20 gigapascal. So the lesson is that, and I think that some correlations are coming into play here. So the lesson for people who are interested in strongly correlated materials is that even for weakly correlated materials, they can become strongly correlated as one applies pressure. And only a few Fermi liquids actually survive to low temperature and high pressure. So far, the only elements that have resisted is gold and silver and copper. But once more, I was surprised by that. I mean, I, at the beginning, I thought exactly what you said, that basically increasing the overlap between the electrons just increases the kinetic energy and nothing happens. But what seems to be happening is several things. First of all, there are structural transitions, so the electrons sort of rearrange, apparently, when you apply pressure. Also, the cores are beginning to do something. A very interesting example, for example, is lithium. Lithium has actually very high temperature superconductivity. It can go up to 15 Kelvin when you pressurize lithium. And if you do the electronic structure calculation, what you find is that there's a reorganization of even the core of those electrons as you pressurize. So maybe one might even be opening shells when under high pressure. It's really a fairly unexpected field. Yeah. Yeah, you expect that So here, things are sort of what I was alluded to, actual numbers for lithium actually superconducts at 20 Kelvin, which is extremely high. Phosphorus superconducts at 18 Kelvin. Sulfur superconducts at 17 Kelvin. Those are basically closed shell systems. When you squeeze them, basically you make them active. And when you make degrees of freedom active, then you're prone to new instabilities such as superconductivity. So people think that pressure just delocalizes the electrons, but pressure can be a way of opening shells that before were completely closed, for example, in sulfur or in phosphorus, and then give rise to new physics. Yes. Yes, this is information taken from the internet. It's completely surprising. And it's also interesting that by then, there were already some electronic structure calculations which said that one should look at lithium under pressure. Yeah. Yeah. So I was very surprised. I mean, that was one of the good things of preparing this course. When I started to look at things and think about this, I find that this field is actually rather remarkable. And I cannot resist but also tell you about my high pressure work.
One question about the pressure.
Yes.
Yeah,
this is hydrostatic pressure. Now, when we talk about cuprates, I will discuss what happens with uniaxial pressure because this is something I'm very interested in these days.
If you apply uniaxial pressure to metals?
No. It's not known because this is a very difficult thing. This field is relatively new. I mean, it's only in the last few years, I mean, in the last 10 years, that people have been able to build the apparatus, which is sufficiently powerful so that they can actually apply the pressure and measure the resistivity and the physical properties. It's easy to apply pressure, but you know nothing about what the material is doing. You really need to put electrodes. You need to understand what the material is doing. And that is not easy work. There are few groups in the world that do that. The other thing that this reminds me of is that there's also the field of high-pressure synthesis. I mean, I showed materials, but this is probably a very, very, very tiny fraction of the possible compounds that we can actually make when we looked at that table. So I think this field has a huge future in the sense that there has to be a lot more in this than the few islands of high temperature superconductivity that we came across so far. So I think there's a lot to be found. So, yes.
Can finish the simple elements?
Yes, I would like to finish. Yes, can I finish the simple elements? I'll tell you something where I was actually very interested in, which is the case of americium. Americium metal was a half a Kelvin superconductor. The way you think about americium is you have a closed F shell where you have all the F electrons in the J equals 5 halves totally occupied, and then you have a broad band of SPD electrons. So it's really the definition of the boring material where we understand everything. The F electrons are doing nothing because they have a completely closed shell, and the bands of SPD electrons are so broad that they are really the poster boy for an itinerant metal. And indeed, if you look at the resistivity of americium without pressure, then you find that basically this is canonical electron-phonon interaction driven resistivity. It's a very small resistivity. We understand pretty much everything. But I was sort of interested in the possibility of pressure because, again, if we apply enough pressure, we had some theoretical calculations that we've been doing over the years that if we put enough pressure on americium, you actually can crack open that F shell. So you can try to have a valence transition in americium. So I was sort of discussing this a lot with the experimentalists in ITU, which were doing those very difficult measurements of trying to take americium and apply pressure. And these are sort of the experimental results, which, again, I could never imagine that would happen. I mean, the TC as a function of pressure in americium has actually two domes, not just one dome. I mean, we're used to this idea that you have a control parameter, and like in cuprates, you vary the control parameter, you have a maximum. It seems to be that there is one maximum, which I don't know what it's due to, and there's a second maximum, which I like to think of as being the result of this type of mode transition of the F electron. What I like to think is that when you go from the americium 3 to the americium 4 phase, the F electron really becomes itinerant. So in here, the electron is itinerant, here is localized. This is the evolution of the resistivity under pressure. And you really see that once you get to the strong correlation region, we have very large resistivity. So that's something that seems to be quite generic and seems to be like a reasonable rule to look for interesting materials in the sense that interesting large resistivities seem to be correlated with high with interesting superconductivity. And one can say that whatever is pairing the electrons may also be scattering the electrons, which is the essence of Migdal-Eliasberg theory, which I will describe in the next part of the talk. So probably this is a good place to take a break, where I finished with the elements, and then my next job is to explain to you the Migdal-Eliasberg theory and of superconductivity.